Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Big Sister Hotline is recorded on the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has never been ceded. I pay my respects to elders past and present. The Hotline is proud to be an ongoing supporter of JIRA, an Aboriginal-controlled community organisation where culture is shared and celebrated. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal, and Black Lives Matter. Big Sister Hotline, how can we help? Hello, dear listeners, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, and welcome back to Season 2 of the Big Sister Hotline, a weekly podcast offering frank, funny, and feminist advice on life, love, and whether or not you should break up with your no-good Nick boyfriend. Spoiler, the answer is always yes. I'm your host, Clementine Ford, author of the books Fight Like a Girl and Boys Will Be Boys, and currently writing the forthcoming memoir, How We Love. My guest this week is Laura Bates, a UK-based writer, activist, and trailblazer working to end men's violence against women. Laura is the founder of the Everyday Sexism Project and the author of Everyday Sexism, the Sunday Times bestseller Girl Up, Misogynation, and The Burning. She writes regularly for The Guardian and The New York Times, and is also the recipient of a British Press Award. Her latest book, Men Who Hate Women, is a blistering look at the ways in which men operate in communities to perpetrate and perpetuate misogyny and violence against women. It's brutal, terrifying, and absolutely necessary for everyone to read. Laura joined me to talk about the numerous issues raised in her book, and I want to use this opportunity to issue a very big content note and trigger warning for our discussion. It contains numerous references to abuse, rape and sexual violence, and murder. Parts of this conversation will not be easy to listen to, so please go gently with yourselves. And if nothing else, I strongly recommend you get the men in your lives to listen, because we need them to understand the truth of what women have been saying for generations. Laura Bates, welcome to the Big Sister Hotline.
Thank you for having me.
I've followed your work for years, but just for people who may be becoming familiar with you now, could you just give a little bit of a background, please, to what you were doing before this and what led you to write Men Who Hate Women?
Sure. In 2012, I started a really simple project called the Everyday Sexism Project, which aimed to crowdsource people's experiences of any kind of gender inequality. And the purpose of it was to try and force people to acknowledge the reality of the problem, because it felt like we were living in a situation where it was impacting on people's daily lives, mostly women's daily lives on a daily basis. And yet there was this kind of social attitude of sexism doesn't exist anymore. Women are equal now. There is no problem. So it was a very, very simple idea to kind of raise awareness and force people to confront the problem. But it took off in a way I hadn't anticipated. And hundreds of thousands of people used the project to share their stories, which meant that we suddenly had the largest data set of its kind that had ever been collected. So I started trying to take the data and to use it in a really targeted way beyond awareness raising offline. So, for example, taking the stories that we'd received from children at school about sexual violence to ministers who were making decisions about the education curriculum to argue that they should have mandatory lessons about consent and healthy relationships, or using the data that just come from women being sexually assaulted or harassed on tubes or buses to work with the British Transport Police to change the way that they dealt with sexual offences and to retrain their officers. And it kind of spiraled from there, really. But a lot of my work focused on young people, because a huge number of the entries we received came from children, from girls under the age of 18 in particular. And that meant that I started doing a lot of work in schools directly, going into schools and talking to young people about the kind of stories we were seeing and about everything from gender stereotyping to the treatment of women in the media and so on. And over the next almost decade, I traveled to maybe two schools a week all over the country. And I was seeing a real cross-section of young people and their ideas and their attitudes. And there was a real shift, I would say, about two and a half years ago, where suddenly the responses from boys in particular changed. And suddenly, of course, there had always been kind of pushback and difficult conversations and awkwardness, and that was to be expected and welcomed. But suddenly I was hearing from boys who were coming out with really extreme and very entrenched beliefs that were extreme misogyny. So real hatred of women, false statistics, the idea that men are the vast majority of victims of domestic abuse, the idea that almost every woman who says she's been raped is lying, the idea that white men are the real threatened victims in our society and that there's a feminist conspiracy at the heart of our government seeking to destroy them. And I recognized these ideas and these tropes because I think as a woman working online, particularly as a feminist, you come into contact with these communities who very deliberately spread these particular myths and who also target individual women for abuse. And for a long time, I think there was an argument that these communities didn't deserve the oxygen of publicity, that there was a danger in talking about them. And I was quite sympathetic to that argument. But what I suddenly started seeing that really worried me was that actually these communities were incredibly successfully radicalizing boys. And that is absolutely what it is. It's radicalization and grooming. But nobody knew it was happening. These kind of specific groups, which actually, the more I looked into it, have carried out murders and rapes. Over 100 people have been killed or injured by them in the last 10 years alone. They are not on the radar of any kind of counterterrorism organization, of any government, of any anti-radicalization scheme that's helping young people. And I suddenly realized if they're having this effect on so many boys, maybe we do need to talk about them so we can see what the problem is. And that's what led me to write the book.
You know, reading this book, it for me in particular, I think that your experience of that of all of this has been much more amplified than mine, but so much of it, in fact all of it, was just incredibly familiar to me, from the trolling that you write about that you've received personally, to, you know, wading through incel groups, to wading through men's rights groups, and even to the experience of going into schools and speaking with students and recognizing that shift. What's so great about it is that you do structure it so much in terms of the silos in which these men operate. So you have men who hate women, and that's looking at incel ideology. You have men who hound women, and that's looking at trolls. Men who blame women, and that's looking at men's rights activists. And what I think is so powerful about it is that the chapter about boys in schools is right at the end, because for me that nails that exactly what you're saying about no one wanting to talk about this or thinking, well, don't give it any oxygen, you know, starve it, as if somehow ignoring it has, as if somehow ignoring abuse has ever made it go away for women. But actually you keep bringing it back to the source, or rather to what we should be concerned about, which is that if it's taking root in our children, this is where we need to kind of cut it off at the knees, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's so nice to talk to you about this, because the experience of talking about this book and writing about it is quite, kind of feels like this mass sort of gaslighting experience. And I don't mean to use that lightly, but it really does feel like you're talking about this mass terror group, essentially. And almost everywhere you go, people have never heard of it. They're going, what? An ill? Mm. In what? Like, is it a kind of battery? And so to talk to someone who knows and who's experienced it and is aware of it is kind of a massive relief. It's really shocking. I mean, during the research for the book, I would be ringing up kind of major counter-terror groups working for various different governments, and you'd start talking to them about the kind of measures they're taking to track different forms of radicalization and extremism, and then you'd use the word incels and it would just go quiet at the other end of the line, and they'd go, "In, sorry, can you repeat that?" And it's this really shocking thing of realizing that, you know, there are government accountability reports in the US, for example, that cover a period in which over 30 people have been murdered by incels and they don't appear on the report, even though it goes into great depth tracking and looking at animal rights extremism in the name of which nobody had been injured during that period. So it's a real relief to talk to someone who kind of has seen it and been aware of it, because I think you're so right. These things, particularly when they affect women, particularly when there's a sense that they have their origins online, they're almost universally belittled and dismissed. And people just really, in the sort of wider community, this whole mass complex ecosystem is boiled down to one word, troll, in most people's minds. And it's a slightly comical, slightly pathetic figure of someone in their mum's basement who would never actually hurt anyone in real life, and it's just to be pitied. And that's terrifying.
Mm. It's interesting that you mentioned gaslighting, because I was telling someone about this book today and I said, I feel like this book could have been called Gaslight, because that experience is so familiar to me, not just telling people about it and having them say, what, incel? And we will talk a minute, we will go into what an incel is in a minute for anyone who may not be familiar with that term. But it's not just about people being unaware of these things. It's coming up against, once again, the backlash from, or the memory for me reading this book, the memory of all of the times that, you know, the most recent of which was today, that you talk about these things, and men in particular, although sometimes women doing the work of patriarchy, insist to you that it's not real, that none of this is happening, and that even if it were happening, well, don't you know that women do it too? I went to my Facebook page today and I shared an image of your book, and I said, I am challenging the men who follow this page to buy this book and read it and really, you know, back up your claims that you make, that you love women, that you want to protect the women in your life. I mean, leaving aside the kind of paternalistic aspects of protection, back it up, because until you read this book and engage with the topic as it actually is, your words are meaningless. And of course, even with that, comments after comment came in from men that who insisted that this was not real, that they weren't like this, that women do it too. And I thought that, you know, it's very little surprises me now when it comes to people actively disengaging from this content and from this topic. But the fact that the book's not even called All Men Hate Women. It's about specifically about groups of men who hate women. And even that is so frightening to people that this is one of the things that I really struggle with in terms of just that kind of naivety that still lives within you, that it's so infuriating to me that we live in a world in which we are gaslit into accepting, or being told at least, that men would bend over backwards to quote unquote protect women. That if I ever saw men abusing women, I would step in and I would say something and I would do something about it. And yet time after time, you and I both know that the opposite is true, that they don't want to talk about it. They don't want to engage with it. And when you say things like, you know, misogyny and incels and, you know, men like Paul Elam who weaponize these groups against women to perpetrate violence against women, these are terrorist groups, you're met with people who either say that you're being ridiculous or who are kind of wishy-washy and on the fence and say, well, we agree that it's wrong, but terrorism's the wrong term to use for it, because as I've been told, Laura, terrorism is about furthering a political ideology, mm-hmm. as if somehow there's nothing political about men wanting to prevent women from rising up.
Right. It's so true. And I think it's not an accident that you have that sense that there is such resistance to it, because the more I researched the book, the more I realized how cleverly those narratives of subduing and preempting any kind of resistance are actively being pushed, not only by these groups themselves, but also by kind of conduits, if you like, people who act as bridges between these really extreme online communities and the mainstream media and our politics. It's really shocking when you start to realize how many mainstream politicians, and actually this is particularly an issue in Australia, are meeting actively with members of these groups and then going on to form policy, to make policy choices and suggestions based on the myth and mythology that these groups are kind of spouting, and even repeating verbatim some of their propaganda. And or you've got mainstream media programs who respond to these kinds of issues in a really problematic way that then perpetuates the misconceptions amongst the general public. So in the UK, for example, we've got some of our most respected affected broadcasters and public programming on the Me Too movement, for example, asking, isn't this a witch hunt against men and should men be scared? You know, you've got the president of the United States, for crying out loud, saying this is a very scary time to be a young man in America. And so you end up with a society where people are much more predisposed to all of those attitudes that you've just listed. You know, oh, I don't know, this, it sounds like maybe you've gone a bit too far, or you must be exaggerating a bit, or there's, you know, actually there's a side to the story that I'm not familiar with. And it's really, I think, the fact that we're not used to recognizing that white men can act as a group. We're not comfortable with that in our society. You know, we are so happy to homogenize and generalize about other groups, but we afford white men this kind of privilege of discrete identities. And so the idea that they as a block might be acting, and of course we're talking about a specific group of white men, not all white men, but the idea that that might be a group is that something that is so uncomfortable for people even to begin to discuss, that it's really hard to get people to even be prepared to have the conversation. And even when these groups commit terrorist acts, the media doesn't call them that. So you're four times more likely to hear about a terrorist act committed by someone who isn't white in the first place anyway. But most people will have heard of some of the terrorist acts carried out by these men. They might have heard of the Toronto van attack, for example. Most people are familiar with that, but very few people know that that was a terrorist act explicitly targeting, killing and injuring the vast majority of the victims being women by an attacker who explicitly said that he was acting in the name of hatred of women, because the media and even the police force came out and said, there's no evidence of terrorism here. The city is safe, they said, even though he was sitting in an interview room telling officers that he'd been radicalized online and wanted to be the next Elliot Rodger, the next incel killer. So it's kind of no surprise then that you have everyday people going, well, it's not really terrorism, is it? Because that's literally what the police, the media, and politicians are telling them.
Well, so let's use the example of Alec Manassian to get into incel ideology so we can explain to listeners who may not be familiar with it what incels are, and then talk about really that, you know, the deep-seated hatred that is prevalent within that ideology. So can you just explain, please, what incel is?
Sure. So incels are a group who term themselves as involuntarily celibate. In other words, they're not having sex and they want to be. And they blame women for that. They believe that women owe them sex, that it's their kind of entitlement, their birthright as men, and specifically as white men. These are overwhelmingly white groups. And it's, I think, impossible to talk about them without recognizing that there's a huge crossover between these groups and white supremacists, who also have a huge obsession with the idea of birth rates, the idea of replacement theory, the idea that essentially white women are a kind of a completely dehumanized, fragile commodity to be used for the purpose of propagation, to be used for the purpose of creating a kind of master white race, the idea that black women should be forcibly sterilized, the idea that men of color are kind of invading savages. You cannot take those two concepts and extricate them from each other. So that's really important to say, I think. They are men who believe that as punishment for the fact that they aren't getting sex, women who entirely have all of the power and control politically and socially in the world should be punished. And they fantasize en masse about raping and murdering women in what they describe as a day of retribution, when incels will rise up and punish women by murdering them. And if this sounds extreme and shocking, and automatically I think you assume I must be talking about a few dozen men, we are talking here about groups where it is a sprawling network of these groups. There are blogs, there are communities, there are networks, there are chat rooms. I investigated so many of these groups for the book, hundreds of separate incel groups and websites and forums, and a single one, for example, had membership of 100,000 people. Another had a membership of 17,500 people. There, a single one of these groups had 5 million posts. Many of them shared fantasies about raping and maiming and murdering women. They share images of women being brutally killed. They post photographs of real women they know and ask for advice on how to rape them. And I'm really sorry to be so explicit, but I think it's really important, because part of the problem is that people have no idea just how bad it is. And that's what we're talking about. That's the severity, and that's the kind of size of the community we're discussing. And this is just one of the communities looked at in the book. So that gives you a bit of an idea of the scale.
To me, one of the things that's most frightening about incel ideology is not just the men who operate within it, who have this incredible level of entitlement. And it's not really, I mean, from my perspective, it is an entitlement to women's bodies, but it's also, and I'm sure you would agree with this based on your book, it's this terrible fury that somehow other men are succeeding in a patriarchy in ways that they aren't, that mm-hmm. they're being denied. You know, so people often say, well, they'll discount Elliot Rodger, for example, who's considered, you know, he's spoken of as being the supreme gentleman within incel circles. They'll discount his actions as being misogynist because they'll say they're always looking for excuses. They're always looking for ways to make men not be bad or not be, you know, capable of these things. But they'll say, well, he can't have been driven by misogyny because he killed men too. Mm-hmm. But as you point out, he killed men who he felt furious were having experiences that he thought belonged to him and that he was being denied somehow. So it's that tussle as well between, you know, where you sit on the hierarchy of male power. And one of the things that I find really galling, I guess, is that, but also incredibly worrying, and this is where I think that, you know, people can dismiss these things as saying, well, even if it's 100,000 people, how many billions of men are in the world? You know, it's not all of us, not all men, not all men. And you think, okay, but we're all part of a system. And maybe the vast majority of men are not operating actively in those incel circles. But I can tell you that I came across a lot of men who move through society normally, who, when Elliot Rodger killed those people in Isla Vista and when Alec Manassian plowed his van into those people, they said things like, well, you know, maybe women should have gone on dates with them.
Yeah,
maybe it's women's fault.
There's such a trickle-down effect here, right? Like, so the first thing is that there are so many men who have taken on some of the aspects of these ideologies in a much more diluted form because they are very deliberately kind of smuggled into the mainstream via kind of memes and funny content on YouTube, and then very, very public figures who have massive chat shows, for example, without naming any names. And so you end up having men in the general public where these ideas are made so much more normalized and palatable and kind of excusable. And so then you get to this point where you have a kind of tiny, or it's considered a kind of tiny fringe internet group, like men going their own way, who believe that you should have no contact with any woman in any way. And yet you suddenly realize that 27% of American men now follow that ideology to an extent, in that 27% of American men now say that they won't have meetings one-to-one with a woman in the workplace, because you might get falsely accused of something. And that's a really good statistic, I think, for just showing just how widespread some of these views have become. Even if they're one step removed from the source of these online communities, they're still incredibly effective in terms of how widespread and therefore how acceptable that rhetoric is becoming. But of course, there's also a huge number of men who wouldn't engage in these particular ideas. And my argument then is, that's fantastic, but that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. And often these are the same people who are so quick to spew Islamophobic rhetoric. You know, they're very happy to see all Muslims as a group when we're talking about another kind of terrorist attack. So, and yet they find it very difficult to recognize that, you know, that's exactly the same thing. Like, no, we're not saying that all white men are committing these acts or have these ideologies, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be able to talk about it. This is a really serious issue.
And nor should we be distracted constantly by the demand that we provide that disclaimer. We shouldn't have to initiate every conversation about the staggering numbers of men who kill, hurt, rape, and harm women with that disclaimer of, well, we know that it's not all of them who do it. Like, that should, let's just take that as read. And yet the fact that so many men who claim to be allies and in support of, you know, if not feminism, then in support of equality in some way, the fact that they still require that disclaimer to be given to them in order for them to feel comfortable in the conversation is very telling about where their entitlement sits on the spectrum too. And Hannah Gadsby did that great piece about the line, you know, men setting the line. And if men determine where the line is between good and bad, then they can always decide which side of the line they sit on. One thing I've observed, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is that when women speak about these issues, of course we know what the backlash involves, and you and I have received some horrific emails, messages, etc. I always think that if that's the sort of stuff that, you know, women who have a platform to expose it are receiving, then what are teenage girls being subjected to, you know, where they have to stay silent about a lot of it. But it's not so acceptable when we speak out about it, because the men, even the ones who consider themselves to be quote unquote the good guys, they don't have any control over those conversations. They can't determine that line and say, well, of course, I'm on the side of good, and that's why I can speak about how terrible these things are. It suddenly becomes a lot. I think that a lot of men experience a degree of insecurity and paranoia when it's women speaking about these things, because all of a sudden there may be something in their behavior that is pointed out that they've done, that they secretly know about, that they might have to sit with and reckon with.
I think that that is a really gritty touch point for these communities to then grab onto. I think if you look at a lot of the backlash to Me Too, it focused on this idea of they might come for you next. You know, are you really safe? If women are speaking out about this stuff, what have you done that might come up? And it's a really clever narrative, because it basically flips on its head the reality. It turns the group who are oppressed into the oppressors, and it's a very seductive narrative, I think, in a moment of public reckoning for people who are having to kind of examine their own privilege. And we've seen the same response to Black Lives Matter protests as well, to try desperately to kind of prevent those people from speaking out by striking fear into the dominant group and making them think like, oh, I might have to look at my own privilege, this is uncomfortable, so I should shut this conversation down. And it's incredibly effective, because it uses fear, which is such a powerful motivator, I think. And you're so right that particular conversation for men then becomes a conversation of real discomfort, and that's a really difficult thing to sit with, I think, as you say.
I found your chapter on the men's rights activists, men who blame women. I found that particularly interesting because, of course, you write about Paul Elam, who's the founder of A Voice for Men, which is one of the, if not the biggest men's rights websites in the world. And it sits really neatly in with your exposure of a lot of these guys who occupy levels of status, you know, whether in online communities or by doing the speaking circuit, that for a lot of them, it's actually a big financial grift. Mm-hmm. Where they're profiting off of what are, in lots of cases, I mean, not every man who's attracted to the pickup artist movement, for example, is there because he's purely a misogynist. As you say, a lot of them are just kind of lonely, insecure men with low self-esteem who think that what they're signing up for is something that will teach them how to communicate with women better. I mean, that's a generous reading of a lot of them, I think, but I do feel that that is true for at least a proportion of them. And yet there are these men there who claim positions at the top, like Paul Elam or Roosh or, you know, Julian Blanc, who was famously kicked out of Australia or had his visa denied. And they're profiting off of it because for them it's a game, and they can exploit the very men who are looking to them for some form of liberation. They will exploit them. And what I found interesting about Paul Elam was, you know, his whole shtick is that he fights for deadbeat dads and, you know, women, the court system is feminized and, you know, women steal the children, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not sure if you read that piece in BuzzFeed about him, that he's a deadbeat dad himself. You know, he walked away from his family, and then after a reconciliation was kind of thrown away from his family again because his daughter, who'd reconciled with him, saw him slap her child. So he's not even espousing the views that he claims to be representing, but he is profiting a lot.
Yeah, I think there is a real exploitation within these communities, and the men at the top are profiting by doubling down on exactly the societal issues that are harming the people who are then being driven to them. So you're right, it's so complex. There are a huge number of very vulnerable, exploited, unhappy men in these communities, some of whom have mental health problems, some of whom have massive disadvantages and issues in their own lives, and some of them are the most vulnerable vulnerable people to being preyed upon online. And I think it's so important to recognize the complexity of those communities, because we can recognize that those men exist within them without what is often done, which is giving a kind of blanket excuse to the whole community and going, oh, incels are just poor men who, you know, are very unlucky in their lives and we should feel sorry for them. Like, that's not what I'm saying. There are a huge number of men in there who do know what they're doing, who are explicitly extremist misogynists, who are advocating sexual violence. But caught up in that are these men who are themselves harmed explicitly by a world in which they are told boys don't cry, men are tough and manly, you have to have power, you have to fulfill these specific stringent criteria for being a man. And in many cases, that's what's created the very kind of vulnerability that has sent them in search of answers online in the first place. And the most tragic thing to see is that they then come across the paths of men in these kind of groups, the kind of leaders that you've described, who end up exploiting them by, instead of saying, there's another way, this isn't the only way to be a man, you know, the kind of things that might actually help and support them, instead they double down. They go, you're right, men have to be in control and in power, and you should hate women because they're the ones stopping us from doing this, and specifically feminists, because if it weren't for women's liberation, we would all be fine. You could almost boil down every manosphere ideology to that. If only women were still chattel, if only they could be our sex slaves and have no kind of political or distinct ideology or any kind of distinct like persona or power over themselves, then we'd be okay. And what that does is it absolutely reiterates exactly the problems that have pushed those men there in the first place. It's really tragic. And I guess what that means is that we have to look at ways to try and break out of that. We have to look at ways to try and provide different opportunities, different conversations, different meeting places, different communities offline, particularly for the younger men who are very vulnerable to these ideologies and find them attractive. Because it isn't a coincidence in the UK, for example, I think, that we've seen so many men being sucked into this at the same time that we've seen massive cuts to youth centres and to kind of offline spaces for young men to gather in real life. And if these spaces are giving them a sense of community and purpose and resolve, then we need to look at ways to provide that in a healthier way offline if we want to tackle it in a meaningful way, I think.
One of the things that concerns me the most, you know, on a personal level as well, because I have a 4-year-old son, is just knowing how easily those boys slip through the cracks. You have a couple of really interesting examples through the book of young men who, I guess you could say, sort of dipped a toe into the world of either pickup artistry or inceldom or men's rights activism. And then, thank goodness, somehow events kind of conspired within their lives to give them a sense of purpose or some level of self-esteem that really drew them out of those communities again, so that they could see what they were, see them in their entirety. But those stories seem to be very rare, mm-hmm. or rare enough that there's not so many men speaking out. And I'm not sure if you listened to the New York Times podcast series Rabbit Hole, but Rabbit Hole was a six-part series, the radicalization of young men, not necessarily just into men's rights activism, but the radicalization of young white men in particular on YouTube and in online spaces. And you talk about the way the algorithm on YouTube works, so that, you know, you set your computer up in the book as an experiment. You set it up so you cleared your cache completely. You had no kind of online footprint. And you just plugged into YouTube, what is feminism? And then you followed the rabbit hole down. And this is what the Rabbit Hole podcast finds as well, is that very quickly this one simple question or something like it suddenly has these young men being exposed to views from men like Stephen Molyneux, who's a white supremacist, quack psychologists like Dr. Jordan Peterson, who, as you point out in your book, people trust because he has a PhD, but not in the fields in which he's speaking. And in my experience here in Australia, one of the things that scares me the most is going into schools and seeing how boys as young as 14 and 15 are, as you say, parroting back these falsehoods. These boys speak with such extreme levels of confidence about issues that they really don't understand, yet they feel they've got all these facts for, because they've watched a lot of hours of YouTube. And I've stopped speaking in schools primarily because whenever I do, I leave and I spend the next 24 hours being horribly trolled by the students. And it's always been incredibly demoralizing to me, because when I go to the schools and I say, look, this is unacceptable behavior, they're really not interested in doing much about it. Everyone tiptoes around young boys, and it leads me to wonder, yes, okay, we want to mold them and we want to have empathy and we want to intervene, but at what point will we actually intervene? Why are grown women like you and I having to deal with this level of backlash when we've been invited to speak as experts in our field? And as I said earlier, if we're dealing with it, what are girls who go to school with them every day having to put up with?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's something I really recognize as well. What I often experience is speaking in a school and then having an email or a message from a girl at that school after I've left saying, this is what happened after you left. I vividly remember one particular school I spoke at where we were talking about feminism. And it was interesting because the school had asked us to have a smaller discussion group with just the girls. And it was only the girls in the room. And there was one girl in that school who was brave enough to say that she was a feminist. And she was just very, very gently and calmly debunking some of the stuff that the others were coming out with. You know, things like in that particular session, they said things like, well, you know, women love playing with babies. So why should companies have to pay for them to do that? You know, I don't understand why maternity leave should be paid. It was that kind of level. And this girl was kind of very calmly saying, well, you know, and giving some ideas. And afterwards, she wrote to me and said the girls who had been in that session went out of it and told the boys that she was a man-hating, hairy feminist. And she then sent me some of the messages she'd received from boys in her year subsequently. And it was things like, you know, it's not our fault. Men are just biologically better than women. And you just have to accept that. Like, we can't help that we are just preordained to be superior to you. You know, it's not your fault. You have a different brain. It's just not so good at certain things. And this is the level of kind of belief that crystallizes in these teenage boys genuinely had come to believe that that was simply fact, that they were sort of gently breaking to this girl. And I think it does just let you see how ingrained these things have become. I think for me, the answer is it's too late to talk to them at 16. It's too late if they've already spent years on YouTube being radicalized, because it is, again, it is radicalization. We'd call it radicalization if it was any other form of extremism, but we don't in this case. But that's what it is. And everybody, all the experts agree that de-radicalization is an incredibly difficult and intricate process that requires huge amounts of resources and skill that, you know, every single school in the country absolutely doesn't have. But if we could prevent the radicalization happening in the first place, that would be far more effective. So I think for me, the answer is go and talk to the kids at the schools, but let's get in there when they're 8 or 9, you know. And of course, the men's rights activists listening will go, feminist propaganda, they went to brainwash the young children. And I'm really talking about the most simple level of giving young people the tools to critique gender stereotypes, giving them the tools to be critical of online sources and to look for, you know, statistical backup for things that they hear online. You know, even things that simple could make a difference in how easily people can be sucked down these rabbit holes. But I think a lot of people have no idea how powerful they are. I think we sit here and talk about, you know, YouTube being a bit of a danger. And people are thinking, well, YouTube, you know, that's where I go for movie trailers and grumpy cat videos. If you're an adult listening, it's so easy to underestimate the sheer muscle, the power that this thing has, because it is the by far the most used social media of young people. It's by far the number one source young people go to for their news, not their entertainment, their news. And if you look at the numbers, 70% of the videos that anyone watches on YouTube are videos recommended by the algorithm. That's how powerful the algorithm is. People are watching more algorithmically chosen videos than anything else. Then you look at the fact that there are more households, more people watching YouTube than households that own a television in the world, 85 billion. Then you look at the fact that 37% of all mobile traffic internationally is accounted for by YouTube. So if you put those two statistics together, a quarter of all mobile internet traffic internationally is just people watching the videos that YouTube has chosen for them. I mean, that is massive. So at that point, what that algorithm is doing becomes so important. And report after report, there's a really good Data and Society report on this, has shown that YouTube is in the clutches of a kind of far-right, extremist, misogynistic influencer network. And they use the algorithm very deliberately to pass an audience between their different networks, their channels. They use a channel to kind of bolster and support another channel. And the way that they work is with the grain of the algorithm. So it doesn't mean the algorithm set up to do that deliberately or that YouTube ever intended any of this, but it does mean that that's the result that we're seeing.
And YouTube's certainly not intervening when it happens.
There are good examples of cases where activists have made it clear that there's an issue to YouTube and that there's a fix that would work, but they've chosen to prioritize instead the kind of bottom line and the numbers of views and clicks and that kind of thing. There are so many examples, I think, of social media companies recognizing that there are things that they could do. We live in a time when social media companies, the single most common thing they do is say, oh, but look at how huge this problem is, right? Like, we care and we're trying and we are doing good things, but you've got to recognize this is, you know, this is huge. And you think, hang on a minute, your income is greater than a small country's. Like, of course you could do this if you cared about it. You've got enough money to hire 100,000 human moderators today and train them properly to do this by hand if your algorithms aren't up to the scratch yet. You know, the idea that this is something kind of that's just too difficult for these absolutely massive companies that are making so much money off all of us is just really sickening. And the trouble is, when we don't hold them accountable, it means that their processes are able to be patchy and based entirely on covering themselves and prioritizing their own reputation. And the people who suffer the most from that are the people who experience the worst forms of abuse. So what happens is they don't bring in a proper method or a proper kind of policy to deal with online abuse. What that means is that a particular case of abuse will hit the headlines. And when that happens, as a journalist, and I've been on both sides of this, the person in the story and the journalist writing about it, you ring up and you get through to the PR company that represents one of these social media platforms, and they go, oh, give me the details. And magically, miraculously, the next day it's all gone and they've taken it away. So in the whitewashed kind of media story, they don't look so bad. But the trouble is, who does the media write about? Those stories only get picked up, generally speaking, when it's a young, preferably attractive, white, middle class, already very privileged person, usually a politician or a pop star, who's experiencing the abuse in the first place. So for those women, there is this recourse that because of the privilege of that public platform that you're afforded because of those identities, you get this quick response from the social media company. But because it isn't done in any kind of systemic way, it means that if you're a woman of color, already statistically receiving far worse abuse, if you're a trans woman, if you're, as you said, a teenage girl, you know, who's not going to be on the front page of the paper, but receiving this mass abuse online, you're not going to see the benefit of any of that action because it's not systemic. So it basically just reinforces the problems we already have in these echo chambers, that the voices that we're hearing and the voices that we don't. And it makes it much more likely that the women who will be driven offline by this kind of abuse are women of color, trans women, disabled women. They're receiving worse abuse, and they're the voices we much more need to hear from. Whereas at least in a position like mine, the abuse is bad, but I'm incredibly privileged in that I have so much support. If I talk about it, people are going to listen, and then the social media companies are going to do something about it. So it's a kind of vicious circle, I think.
Can we just have a moment peer-to-peer where we scream into the void at the situation as it is, but also at the incredible hypocrisy that we encounter daily doing this kind of work from men who, on the one hand, scream about free speech and, on the other hand, do everything they can to silence women? It's to me, it's just... It comes back to that feeling of just being constantly gaslighted. And I agree with you, you know, you don't want to use that term too lightly, but I think that that's what it is that, you know, from girls going to school and hearing from their male peers, well, we're just superior to you, and then seeing other girls back that up because they've learned that, at least for now, coordinating with patriarchy is safer for them than challenging it, to then men online who troll women, who send them horrific death and rape threats and drive them offline, all of that designed to shut women up in an environment where men are also at the same time saying, well, we should be allowed to say whatever we want. What happened to freedom of speech? And if you can't hack it, then, you know, get off the bloody internet. Like, men are so sensitive, and not in a good way.
So true. We've actually just had a study that's been published here where they looked at the kind of mental health and self-esteem and self-harm amongst teenage girls and found that it's incredibly high and much higher than it is for teenage boys. And they the kind of outcome of this study has been to blame it on girls' social media use. So they've basically gone, silly teenage girls, you know, doing all these selfies on Instagram, they're bringing it on themselves. And literally nobody in the context of this survey has gone, we know that one third of teenage girls in the UK experience sexual assault at school. We know that there's a rape every day of term in a UK school. And that's just the ones reported to the police. So we're probably looking at least 10 times that figure. It's unbelievable, but it's backed up. That attitude is backed up by the media and by, you know, politics. And it's so difficult to fight against something when the whole system is working against you.
I will be in the first line of people to put my hand up and say, men are broken and we need something to help put them back together. And that work has to come from men as well. But the system is broken. Patriarchy is broken. Patriarchy breaks men. Yeah. I will not disagree with anyone who says that men are hurting. I get that. But the solution to men's hurt from so many of these misogynist groups is to demonize, hurt, and harm women and to blame us for it rather than look to us as people who actually want to see them get better. And one of the things that I find so frustrating is that within this narrative of men's strength and superiority, well, men are just, you know, we're always being told, well, men are just better at everything. That's why they rule the world, because they're just naturally superior. We're also being told, well, men are suffering. Men are suffering so much, and it's you women who've done it to them. So which is it? It's like, mm-hmm. It's the constantly shifting goalposts that is so difficult to deal with. And also, as you say, we know that, I mean, I know that you cite the statistic in your book that men are three times more likely to end their lives by suicide. But we also know that women and girls are three times more likely than that to make an attempt on their own life. And no one seems to care about the significant layers at play there that contribute to girls wanting to self-harm and carrying out self-harm. I mean, there's a group, you mention it in your book, Bloke's Advice, and they met with Pauline Hanson, who is obviously one of our most reprehensible politicians here, who is doing significantly dangerous work by bringing the narratives of men's rights activists into the parliament. But Bloke's Advice is a group that I did a lot of expose on a few years ago because there was just horrific misogyny abounding in there, you know, rape memes, pedophile memes, domestic abuse memes, you know, all that kind of good, funny comedy stuff. And I remember when I was talking about it, when I was sharing these screenshots, because funnily enough, men who talk about free speech and everyone else kind of just getting over it and, you know, finding a sense of humor, et cetera, never like other people to see what they say in private, do they? So when I exposed these men, one of the counter arguments that I kept hearing was, you don't understand the good that these groups do. We've got men in Bloke's Advice that are depressed. You know, some of them have been suicidal and they've reached out and they've all helped each other. And that's the importance of these groups. And again, I said, you know, I'm sure that you've got a familiar experience with this kind of thing. That's bloody wonderful. I'm so glad that you have online spaces and communities where you can connect as men and you can listen to each other and you can offer support and guidance. But why do those groups have to be formed? You know, why does that support have to be mitigated by you bonding over the abuse of women? And how can you defend those spaces as a place for men to really work through the trauma of their mental health while contributing exactly to the very things that cause women to end their lives?
Absolutely. And why should women be collateral damage? Because that's basically what you're saying. This is a thing of value. So the fact that, you know, women are being threatened with rape and abuse, that should be something that we're prepared to accept as a kind of necessary byproduct, which is the argument that we always hear, right? Like, you know, this is just the women. It's not so important. Let's focus on this thing. I think the tragic thing about so many of these groups actually in the so-called manosphere is that they often have identified a real harm or a real point of a grievance, a real problem, essentially. So they identify issues like the male mental health crisis or an issue like a particular kind of cancer that specifically affects men, or an issue around, you know, men in particular workplaces experiencing high rates of workplace injury. And then they turn around and they choose a target to blame for it, and it's always the wrong target. So they identify a real problem, but then they place blame on women and feminists in particular. And by doing that, they kind of find a target to kind of focus all this vitriol and ire at. But because feminists and women are not responsible for those issues, they're never doing anything that improves the problem at all. And for some of those men, that just means that they end up enmeshed in this kind of mire of depression and very, very negative and violent online hatred that kind of drags them down. And for a few of them, it means that they continue to profit from those men, as we've discussed, because of the very fact that they are enmeshed and they can't go anywhere. They're trapped, and then they're kind of a captive audience. But if we were to focus on the actual sources of the issues that those men are describing, then we might get somewhere. And in many ways, I think that's the best way to undercut these groups, is to actually focus on resolving the problems they tend to claim to care about, because they do nothing to actually deal with those problems. You know, these are groups that talk about male domestic abuse survivors as a huge part of their rhetoric. But instead of actually looking at issues to support male victims of violence, male victims of sexual violence, who are overwhelmingly victims of male sexual violence, they spend their entire time and energy bringing lawsuits and protests to try and tear down a refuge for abused women. If we were to actually tackle male mental health, for example, if we were actually to provide better support within the community for adolescent mental health problems, if we were to tackle gender stereotypes in schools that lead to some of those problems in the first place, then we might actually be able to solve the problem. But these men don't want us to take any of those kind of measures, because they're not actually interested in resolving the problems. They're just using them as a kind of stick to beat women with.
Men are, as you say, are 300 times more likely to be targeted by rape, to be victim survivors themselves of rape, than they are ever to be accused falsely of having perpetrated it.
Yeah. So in the UK, a man is 270 times more likely to be raped himself than falsely accused. And most people are flabbergasted by that statistic. And I think what that tells you is that it's another one of those myths that is actually very quietly and very successfully penetrated our society. The idea that false allegations of rape are extremely common. And the reason why it's done that so successfully is because, again, these groups are aided and abetted by the mainstream media and public figures. So in one particular period, when the Crown Prosecution Service here was actually investigating false rape allegations to try and debunk this statistic, they discovered that in a period of about 18 months, there'd been 35 cases. And in many of those cases, it was very complex. So it was often, for example, someone who'd been seriously sexually assaulted and the charge had been slightly wrong. So it was a vanishingly small number compared to the number of women raped during that period. But during that period as well, in a roughly comparable period, one of our biggest tabloid newspapers had published 54 headlines containing the phrase "cried rape." So in other words, our very kind of lurid and controversial reporting on false rape allegations outstrips the number of actual false allegations almost by double. So it's no surprise that people have this misconception about how common the problem is. And that works in favor of these communities so, so much.
And on that topic as well, I'd just like to also say this for the listeners and to anyone who may not be familiar with these statistics who is listening, that when people talk about false rape allegations or false rape accusations, oftentimes what they and statistics themselves are not taking into account is that for something to be deemed quote unquote false, it just needs to have the charges be dropped. And that, you know, and we know that many, many victim survivors of rape and sexual assault drop charges or cease pursuing charges for numerous reasons, the chiefly among them being that we live in a rape culture that does not provide space or support to victim survivors of rape and sexual assault, but also because there may be deemed to be not enough evidence, or because the police themselves may have insisted on dropping the charges. So if you are having those conversations with people and they are insisting on bringing up this kind of furphy and the boogie monster of the false rape accuser, it's not just that the statistics are very, very small, in that between 2 to 7% of all you know, it's the same basically as false allegations across any other crime. But there are mitigating circumstances that may be more likely to have that accusation declared unpursuable, basically, which a lot of people interpret as being the same thing as false. And we know that that's not true.
Absolutely. That's so important to say. I mean, the statistics are just so stark. When we're talking about false allegations, in many cases, we've just seen a big story here in the UK about the police dropping cases because they consider them weak. And we have a situation here where in 2019, there were 55,259 rapes reported to the police, and they prosecuted 2,100 of them, and there were 1,439 convictions. So if you want to talk about a kind of real issue in terms of numbers, like, that's what we should be looking at. And we don't talk about false allegations in relation to any other crime in the same way. If we're speaking about victims of burglary, we don't say, hey, on our biggest broadcaster, let's get someone else on to come in and argue, well, wait a minute, we should think about people who claim to be burgled and they actually haven't been, in the context of this conversation. Because what that does is it undermines people, victim survivors. Mm-hmm. And it means that we have this idea that the numbers are skewed. And so this is where the idea comes from, I think, that, you know, Me Too's gone too far. People are making false things up. Men are losing their jobs all over the place. And a lot of people genuinely believe that, because we've got this kind of mainstream media pushing that narrative because they want the controversy and the clickbait of a debate, when it's so irresponsible as simply as bad reporting. Because if you look at the numbers, you've got 12 million women in the first 4 months alone of the resurgence of the Me Too movement who shared their stories of abuse, of sexual violence, of workplace discrimination. You've got around 200 men in total estimated by the New York Times to have faced any kind of consequences or sanctions as a result of allegations that came out of the Me Too movement. So just look at those numbers. You've got 200 men facing any consequences. Over 12 million women who've experienced abuse. The idea that this is swung in the other direction, and that's before you recognize that most of those, the vast majority of those 200, face some minor professional consequences, which were often then kind of taken away down the line. We're not even talking about men facing actual legal action for what they've done. And the numbers, again, just completely debunk this idea that it's one woman making up a completely false story and employers are acting to cut that man's job without any kind of due process. In that New York Times investigation, there were almost 1,000 women. In other words, for every one man who had said, who had faced any consequences, there had to be over 4 female accusers on average before that action was taken. Because we don't believe women, because we don't take them seriously. So
At the same time as telling women constantly that they need to be on guard at all times because the world is dangerous.
Right, which is another thing that statistically makes no sense, because you're safer statistically in an alleyway at 2 o'clock in the morning in a short skirt, drunk, with your knickers around your head, all the things that women are told, if we don't do them, we will just keep ourselves safe from rape, than you are at home in your pajamas in your own bed. Because 80% of rapists already know the perpetrator. It's a colleague, a friend, a partner, a husband, a boyfriend. So it's all, it comes back to gaslighting, really, doesn't it? It comes back full circle to the beginning of our conversation, that there are these enormous harms, and yet we're living in a world that tells us it's really our own fault. We are the ones that have the power to stop it. And actually, shouldn't we be thinking about poor men instead?
I want to finish with 2 points and or 2 questions, really. The first is, when I was writing Boys Will Be Boys, I appreciate that for you the process of writing this book must have been incredibly toxic for your mental health, because it's very difficult to stay in those environments for the length of time that it takes to write a book and not be impacted or affected in some way. One of the things that I came away with was a really dark and desolate realization that it's not just that people don't believe that rape and sexual assault happens. They just don't believe that all of the examples they have of it happening are actually rape or sexual assault, because they may like the men who perpetrated it, or they may have done something like that themselves, or they just don't want to live in a world where they can say, yes, men do terrible things, because, you know, they imagine that it's just shadows that peel out of the wall and that they're responsible for all of the harm that's done to women, not real life flesh and blood men. And one case in particular that I think of often is Ched Evans, who was a soccer player in the UK who was convicted of sexual assault, rape or sexual assault, went to jail, and then appealed his conviction afterwards and had it overturned. When I look at the facts of that case, I don't see how anyone, even people who are staunchly saying that's not rape or sexual assault or he didn't do it, which I think is bullshit, but I don't see how anyone can look at the facts of that and what he did to that woman in that hotel room and say, well, that's fine. That's fine. That to me was one of the darkest things that I came away with, was that people are altogether too willing to let not just humanity be stripped of women in experiencing and being subjected to these violent acts, but to stand by as humanity is stripped from men and we expect nothing better from them than that. So I'd be interested to know, Laura, on the sort of the darker side of things, what was it that you came away most profoundly from writing this book that you feel like you'll never be able to shake off?
I think the thing that I wasn't prepared for, in spite of, you know, I thought I was pretty prepared when I went into this, because it had been nearly 10 years of getting 200 death threats and rape threats a day, and I thought I'd seen the worst of it. I think the thing that I found the most difficult was the number of pages on these sites that are explicitly devoted to victims who have been raped or murdered by these men, and just to absolutely pouring out hatred of them. So the example that really kind of broke me, I think, about halfway through the research process, there was a mass shooting event, and it had been alleged by a number of the pupils, it was a school shooting, that the motivation had been that the killer had been kind of stalking a girl at the school, or that she'd kind of spurned his advances. And I don't know to what extent that was the case or that was true. But there was this specific incel site that was obsessed with the idea that they hoped that he'd raped her before he murdered her, so that she would die knowing that the man that she'd rejected had been inside her. That was how they described it. And it was something that my editor thought we shouldn't put in the book, because she thought it was just too sickening a thing to repeat, and that it would just be too difficult to read. But for me, it really represented, it's kind of exactly what you've just said, really. It wasn't in doubt that this thing had happened. It was that this woman had been murdered and they still wanted to pour more hate on her. Like the extent of the hatred of women could be so great that you could be prepared to engage in this kind of mass act of pouring vitriol on someone who was already dead at the hands of a member of these communities. And I think that was a low point for me in terms of just realizing what we're up against, you know, just how bad it is. I think the young age of the people who are coming into contact with these communities and the organized nature with which they're targeting them was the other thing that I really came away feeling really distressed about. Because it is so deliberate. They are going to places where young people are. They're not waiting for young people to stumble into the kind of spider's web of incel communities. Many of the young people who end up taking on this ideology wouldn't necessarily know the word incel. They're so much cleverer than that. It's not about boys becoming members of these groups or going looking for them. They are deliberately and very kind of with laser-like precision targeting gaming chat rooms, gaming channels, strategy chat rooms for massive multiplayer online games. They might be speaking over the headset to a boy who's at home in the UK, looks like he's just on his own playing a game to his parent, but he's actually connected to other players online. Or they're targeting things like bodybuilding forums, which at first I found really confusing. Why are all these posts about incel stuff some of the most popular posts on a bodybuilding forum? And then I looked into it more and realized that the vast majority of the members of this bodybuilding forum were young teenage boys. And if you are looking for the teenage boys who are most likely to be vulnerable to these ideologies, you found them, right? The boys who are most concerned with stereotypical projections of masculinity. And I think realizing that and seeing these men describe internet memes and funny jokes as adding cherry flavor to children's medicine, as a specific conduit to try and smuggle this radicalization into these boys' lives, and explicitly seeing misogynistic extremism as a slipway to white supremacy. They specifically talk about the fact that they think misogyny will be a more palatable first step for teenage boys, and they use it very deliberately as a way to then send them down a white nationalist and then a white supremacist pathway. I think for me, that was what made me feel quite overwhelmed. This isn't just something that's out there and it's happening. It's huge. It's organized. It's worse than you could imagine. And it's targeting boys ruthlessly.
I think it's really important for people to know that when you collate information like this, as you have done, when you perform a service in aid of shining a light onto these communities, and you've been at the forefront there wading through the muck of it, that it's not fair for you to necessarily hold on to all of that trauma yourself. That I think that we bear a collective responsibility as an audience and as readers and as people who hopefully want to change the world to actually truly understand what it is that you've been through collecting that information. So thank you for sharing that. On a final note, and hopefully a more uplifting one, I would love to know what hopefulness you walked away from after writing this book.
When you consider what we've talked about today, and when you consider how entrenched those ideas are amongst teenage boys, and I would say that, of course, again, we're not generalizing. I'm meeting loads of teenage boys who are increasingly feminist and want to help. I'm not saying all teenage boys, but when you consider how entrenched those ideas are, the teenage girls who are faced with them are utterly, utterly inspiring. Their courage and their humor and their innovation and their bravery in standing up to it is absolutely without a doubt the thing that keeps me going, that gives me strength and hope for the future. Because if you imagine being faced with that, I mean, when I was at school, it was bad enough, but the idea of being at school now alongside boys who are being kind of almost having this drip fed to them, this kind of extreme misogyny, this content, and having to be the girl that's in the classroom dealing with that. I mean, if you stop for a moment to really think about what that must be like, or to be the girl who dared to say that maternity leave should be a thing, and then she gets told that she's biologically, genetically inferior. And in the face of that, these girls who ironically are being denounced as a group of snowflakes, as a snowflake generation who, you know, are just all obsessed with victim culture, their strength is steely. It's incredible. And they are so great at taking things into their own hands, whether it's, you know, the girls at a school in the States who were told that they weren't allowed to wear yoga pants because they might distract the boys. And they came to school with placards the next day. They picketed saying, are my pants lowering your test scores? Or, you know, whether it's the girls in one of the schools I visited where they'd seen the boys on social media kind of mouthing off about the presentation before I arrived and planning the best ways to disrupt it. And instead of kind of telling a teacher or raising it, what they chose to do was to leave their final lesson a few minutes early to come to the auditorium and to space themselves out in every other seat throughout the hall so that when the boys arrived, they had to sit between two girls, every single one of them. And it just took away that sense of a kind of dissenting block and the peer pressure of the boys actually to respond in that way to the talk. And it was so clever and so sharp and so simple. And that was the way that they chose to take it into their own hands. They didn't look for help. They dealt with it themselves. There was one school I visited where the girls had been walking into the classrooms and boys were shouting out a number out of 10 for them to rate them as they walked in. But it was actually three numbers. Every girl would come in and they would go 7, 2, 4, and they would be rating their faces, their breasts and their bums. And these girls were perhaps 12 years old and being dehumanized to that extent publicly in their lessons, in their education environment. And they responded by asking me to come in and talk to the other people in their school. And when I came in, I thought, you know, they might not want anyone to know it was them that asked me to come in, because that's quite common when you go into a school that no one wants to be associated with it, because that's how bad the backlash is. And these girls, there were maybe 5 or 6 of them, and they were linked. They were sitting in the front row with their arms linked, and they were all wearing T-shirts. And they gave me a T-shirt, and then they made all the boys sign a pledge about sexual harassment as they left the hall. And at the end of that day, I took the T-shirt off when I was going to bed. And I only realized at that point when I got home that on the back it said, I am 10 out of 10. And it was just this moment of being like, yeah, these girls have got this. Like, they're not taking it lying down in spite of everything that they're up against. And, you know, they will be the future. And there are boys with them. There were these three boys that came up after the end of a talk, and they waited until everyone else had left the hall, because it's obviously the peer pressure for boys not to stand up to this stuff. And they came up to him and they kind of whispered, "We were thinking about starting a feminist society and we were just wondering." And then they kind of looked at each other and they went, "Are we allowed?" It was just so great. Oh. So there is hope. You know, we're seeing so many more male role models speaking out about this stuff. It is shifting. It will shift, but it won't shift on its own. And that's this attitude that we're so often told to sit down, shut up and wait. You don't know how good you have it. I was told by a very important politician in the UK that I was very glass half empty and I sounded really negative after being invited to speak to MPs about sexism and gender inequality. And didn't I know that girls these days have never had it so good? And if we were just patient, things had already got better and they would continue. And that attitude suggests that things are getting better on their own magically, and it erases the work of thousands of women over generations to keep pushing it on. So, you know, we can't just sit back, but we will get there.
Well, and also, what's the gender makeup of
we
Britain's
just
Parliament?
Managed to reach a third with great celebration.
Great. Great. Well, clap that, you know, it's just magically sorted itself out. Look, I think that that's a really wonderful note to end on, because I completely agree with you. I look at, yes, there are some young girls who are yet to be awakened to patriarchy and their power to rise up against it, but that's okay, because they'll get there and we'll be waiting for them when they're here ready to join us. But there are so many inspiring young girls and women who are just 20 billion times far ahead on their journey at their age than I could have ever hoped to have been. And it really does give me a lot of confidence for the future that, you know, things can change. Boys and men want something better for themselves too. I think that it's one of the saddest things for me is that when you're doing this work, and I'm sure you have this experience too, that as much as I don't want to engage with people who, you know, accuse me of being a man hater or whatever, I will say to you that one of the saddest parts about that is that I do this work because I love men as well, you know, and I love my son. I love thinking about what men could be. It's hard for me to read even the chapter about incels in as like horrific as it is, and to not think what was the point where something went wrong for them. I think that approaching things with empathy and with the desire to change and grow together as a community is so powerful. And that's what I see young girls being really, really willing to do. And, you know, if you have to expose the most awful parts of society in order to do that, then that's what you need to do. So on that note, I'd really like to say thank you so much for wading into this topic. Thank you for your service over the years for feminism and for girls and women and for boys and men too. And thank you for getting up every day and continuing to do the work, even though you have so many forces trying to stop you.
And likewise, right back at you.
It's been really wonderful to speak to you. Your book is Men Who Hate Women. It's out now. People can buy it from all good bookstores. You're also going to be speaking on live stream at the All About Women Festival, which I will share the details of the particular date, but that will be accessible, obviously, remotely, because that's the world that we live in now. And I really hope that you've been able to find a soft space to land after writing this, because you deserve it for sure.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Big Sister Hotline, a weekly advice podcast that delivers no-nonsense words with love from the kind of people you know have your back, your big sisters. If you have a question, you could submit it to bigsisterhotline@gmail.com. And don't worry, all submissions are treated as totally anonymous. We're big sisters and we've got your back. If you'd like to support the ongoing making of this podcast, you can find me on Patreon under the username Clementine Ford. My guest this week has been Laura Bates, writer, activist, and author of the brand new book, Men Who Hate Women. It is a difficult read, but it's a necessary one, and I would love for you all to get it. Please ask the men in your lives to read it and discuss it with them. It is essential that we have these conversations. Remember, there's no topic too thorny and no question too weird for the Big Sister Hotline. We're here for all the questions you don't want to ask your therapist, especially now that it has to be over Zoom. So contact us instead. The Big Sister Hotline. The phone lines are open.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.